The Round Golf Podcast with Richard Kaufman.
Hello again. Thanks for coming back and joining us for another episode on this The Round Golf Podcast. Sometimes I get to speak to big name players, sometimes lesser known players, hopefully people that you want to listen to. Now, this episode obviously has one of the all-time greats, Gary Player. You know, you think of Jack Nicklaus, Arnold Palmer, Seve Ballesteros, these kind of players. Player is in that category, isn't he? Now, normally when we do the round, obviously we start with the round that changed their life, was most significant to their career. It was a bit hard trying to pinpoint Gary Player down to one round. That's the problem when you've won as many tournaments and as many majors as he's done. So I kind of let him off the hook a little bit. Hopefully it doesn't detract from the overall interview. Now, in it, of course, you'll notice I refer to him as Mr. Player quite often. I was told by a colleague that was the way he likes to be addressed. And I suppose when you have won over 100 events around the world over so many decades, you kind of earn that respect, don't you? Anyway, love to hear what you think of this. Let's listen to the interview.
Mr. Player, I know you don't want to come across boastful, but I think it's a bit difficult when you've won 165 tournaments across your career. I mean, it's been an incredible journey. So how can you not be a little bit boastful when you've achieved as much as you have in your career?
I'd like to put it across as not being humble and not being boastful. I think the difference between arrogance and humility is a very fine line, because you've got to be confident that you're going to do something. I'll give you an example. When I was in my prime, they'd always say, well, who do you think is going to win the tournament this week? And I'd say, well, I think I'm going to win it. And some thought it was arrogant. But there was no point in me going to the tournament unless I believed I was going to win it. Is that, you agree with that?
Yes.
No point at all. So when you ask me a question, I'm going to tell you exactly the right answer and not sort of beat around the bush.
The hard thing for me is to know is where to start. Normally when I do these podcasts, I get someone to choose a round, but we've already got to the fact that you've won so many tournaments, so many championships. In a way, am I right in saying it'd be a little unfair for you to pick out one?
It'd be very difficult, because when I start off, I'm the youngest man to ever win the British Open, and I had no money. I was very poor. My wife had to fly over from South Africa, and I was in America. I couldn't even fly over to see our firstborn child. Had to meet her here and go to the Muirfield for the first Open Championship. I say British Open so people can understand it.
Sure.
Although it is the Open. So I go to Muirfield and I go to the club. I don't know, it's a sticky club. And I walk in there and the secretary says, what do you want here? It's like that, not good morning. What do you want here? I said, well, I've come to practice. He says, you're not practicing here, my boy. I said, I'm poor. My wife's just had a baby. I'm going to win the Open. He says, not only that. He says, you're an arrogant young bastard as well. Can you imagine? So now I've got to befriend him, and I did. And he was sympathetic and let me practice, and I went on to win the Open. And he was so pleasant. Colonel Evans Loam was his name.
Well, let's start there, because the first is probably the sweetest.
Yes.
That Open Championship, when you walked off at Muirfield, you just, I think, three-putted, double bogey. Did you think that was going to be the moment?
I thought I'd blown it. It was a very windy day. Strong wind. I was playing with a ball that went 50 yards less than it does now, with inferior equipment. Greens were not cut with good machines. The bunkers were not raked with a machine that they're the same every time. There were spike marks, at least 200 spike marks on every green. Now you have none of those. And with the wind and rain, Phil Mickelson's score a few years ago with no wind only beat me by 4 shots. So that was a very proud moment for me. And that set me on the road to winning the Grand Slam, which meant so much to me. And I think, having struggled in my life and having had nothing, to win the Open meant so much more to me, because it enabled me to be confident, it enabled me to keep traveling and to play. And I didn't have sponsors, nobody sponsored me. There were no sponsors in those days.
So let me go back, if you don't mind, and you can tell me to mind my own business, but I'm very interested in the human side, mm-hmm, of where you came from. You've touched on it a few times of when you turned up at Muirfield, you didn't have very much, mm-hmm, yet you walked away with a claret jug. Mm-hmm. Now, I know you had a very difficult childhood, and maybe that has given you the inner strength to achieve what you've achieved. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, the greatest gift you can have in your life. Nobody can give you a greater gift in life than suffering, than having adversity. So many people have a sense of entitlement. And so my mother died when I was 8.
She had cancer, yes.
She had cancer. My father was working in a gold mine, making £100 a month. I hardly saw him. My brother was at war at 17. And so I had to go to a school, a great school, which saved my life, called King Edward VII, a very English school. Hour and a half to school, hour and a half came back. I came back to a dark house. I had 8 years of age. I had to cook my own food, iron my own bed, do my washing. And I lay in bed wishing I was dead. Every night of my life, I was crying, wishing I was dead. And yet that's what made me become a champion, because when you played against me, you knew you were playing against a competitor. I was never going to give up, ever. And that's why I won so many tournaments. I won the Open 7 shots behind. I won the Masters 7 shots behind. I won at least 10 tournaments in my life 7 shots behind. So I never could give up because I struggled so much. And we didn't have much money. And even with all the 165 tournaments and the 18 majors I won, there was no money. I mean, my first three Masters together were 20,000, 20,000, and 40,000. First prize now is 2 million. So we never had any money. But we didn't play the game for money, really. We played the game to be the best. I would have given all my money away if you said to me, would you rather take the British Open and finish first with no prize money, or finish second and take all the prize money? I'd take the trophy with no money.
This 8-year-old boy, how long was this cycle of, how far did you have to go to school by yourself? Was it
I had to go till I finished school.
Distance-wise, I mean, you were traveling.
Well, I took a tram, which is a streetcar, into town, and then I walked across town at 8 years of age. Today, what child would you allow to walk across any town in the world by himself at 8?
And putting yourself to bed, cooking for yourself, cleaning for yourself.
It's unheard of.
And how long did that?
Well, no, excuse me, I shouldn't say it's unheard of. The majority of the children in the world today don't have a TV, they don't have 3 meals a day, they don't have clothes, they don't have a school, they don't have parents, they don't have a motor car, they don't have air conditioning. The majority of the children in the world. So I'm not going to say mine was the worst, but mine was tough.
And you were 8 years old, and how long did this kind of lifestyle cycle go on for?
Well, I eventually started playing sports, and I excelled at sports. I got full honors for 4 sports, and I started getting confidence in myself and not feeling sorry for myself and building a confidence. And I can't go back and say exactly how many years it was, but it made a big difference. And going to the school, the high standard of education, the school that I went to today speak 5 languages. They know about world affairs. And you had a dress code, which I think is lacking in professional sports today. That's why I loved Wimbledon, all dressed in white and looking smart. I think dress code is important. My great hero, Winston Churchill, said, manners maketh a man. That school really was so strict on manners. If you didn't stand up when the teacher came in the classroom, if you didn't take your hat off, for me to sit like this with a hat on in this room for an interview today, my father would have given me a crack across my head.
And hopefully I've got off on the right foot by calling you Mr. Player as well. And you mentioned your father there. I know he was a very hardworking man. Mm-hmm. How did he invest in you by this school? Why did he invest with this school? And how did you end up with a golf club in your hand?
Well, my father wanted me to have a good education. He had to leave school when he was 15 because he had to go and work in the gold mines to support his family because his father died. And he put great emphasis on education. He put great emphasis on a brand. Can you believe it? He didn't know about professional sport, but he put emphasis on a brand. And he said, I'm prepared to struggle in life and take an overdraft to make sure that you can get a good education. And when I told him I wanted to be a golf pro, he was very upset. Very upset. And then I said to him, don't worry, it'll be the best education in the world because I'm going to hit more balls than anybody that ever lived. And this pair of hands you're looking at hit more balls than any human being ever. Now, Vijay Singh, they say, hits a lot. But he's got another 30 years to go before he's my age. He might not live that long, and I'm still hitting balls. So, you know, it was an inner confidence, an inner gift. I call it a divine gift, what happened with me. You cannot have that success, be this small, travel the way I traveled around the world with no jets, traveling with 6 children, 40 hours to America, 40 hours to Australia, unless it's a divine gift. And that's my assumption, that's my conclusion that I've come to. Now, atheists would laugh at that, obviously, but I laugh at atheism, so it's fair.
Because at 16, you announced you were going to be the number one player.
I did, and I mean, why did I do that? Why did I do that? Why do you find in golf, Tom Weisskopf was better than Jack Nicklaus. I think Jack Nicklaus is the greatest sportsman that has ever lived on the planet. You know why? Because he won 18 major championships and was second 19 times and third 3 times. Think about that.
Well, listen, I don't think there'll be, in terms of golf at least, I don't think too many...
No, not golf, any sport in the world.
No, I know. Well, I mean, it's a big debate and I want to talk about you.
It's a big debate, yeah.
But in terms of you, you said you were going to be number one at 16. Mm-hmm. Are you saying it was...
It was a divine gift.
It was ordained on you?
Yeah, it was ordained on me. I believe that, yeah. I really do, because it's just not possible for somebody of my stature travelling around the world with 6 children and having to live the life that I lead, playing against champions in their own country and beating them all the time. You cannot be that good. It's a gift. I never think I was that good. I really genuinely mean that. I never really thought I could be that good. I was aware that it was a gift for me.
Okay, so you mentioned you turn up at Muirfield to win your first major. By the time you get to the US Open of 1965, and you complete the Grand Slam, how different a person are you then now? It's what, 6-7 years on?
Massively different. Lots of education, having traveled around the world, knew about world affairs, were very interested in, and I'd like to be known as the greatest orator of all athletes, because they're renowned as very poor speakers. It was the word called experience. An experience is something that you can't just gather in a moment. Now, if you are wise, I always went to Ben Hogan, who was the best player I ever saw. I never saw a man swing the club like Ben Hogan, not even close. If we saw him again on television here today, 1953, when he won here at Carnoustie. If I was a young pro today, I'd get that clip and I'd have it replayed in my lounge every day if I was a real keen golfer, and watch him swing. It was phenomenal.
You idolised him?
I idolised him as far as his swing was concerned, not as far as his lifestyle was concerned.
Because didn't he want to sign you?
He did, and it was the biggest mistake I didn't do. He offered me $2,000 and I went with another company for $9,000 because I had to have money to travel around the world.
It must have been hard to turn down your idol.
It was, and it was a mistake in retrospect, because he would have shown me things in the swing. I only met one man in my whole life that knew the golf swing from A to Z, okay? I met a lot of people that know the golf swing from A to Y. I think there's a great lack of knowledge in the golf swing today. I meet so many young guys, I say, what do you think about in the swing? And when they tell me, I can see why they're never gonna be a champion.
I don't want you to necessarily name names.
No, I wouldn't.
But does that surprise you when you obviously knew your swing?
No, not my swing, the correct swing.
No, but
you might look different with your build and the way you look, but there's still the right theory. There's only one way to start the downswing, and there's only one way to start the backswing. But you know how many people know that? I could name you players in this field that could win the Open that don't do it.
It's very interesting. I want to go back to 1965, though. I know a few years earlier, you'd gone to the chief executive of the USGA. You had a chance to win the US Open of 1962. You didn't. And you told him, like you announced you were going to be number one, you told him you were going to win the US Open one day, and when you did, you would donate all the money to certain charities for cancer.
Yeah, because for cancer and junior golf. And I said, if the prize money is $1 million or it's 20, I will do it. And then 3 years later, I won. And the nice thing about that, by giving the money back to the USGA, many pros then started following suit and handing prize money back. And golfers are the best athletes in the world at helping unfortunate people. I'm very proud of golfers in the past, and not so much in the past because they didn't have any prize money. Ben Hogan only won $750,000 in his life, I think. But the golfers of our era and now, they're all generous in handing charity work.
But in 1965, going back to, I've only read these things because obviously I wasn't able to watch it at the time, but you had some strange clubs?
Oh yes, I had, because I was offered a lot of money to play the clubs at that time.
Fiberglass.
Fiberglass. I didn't know much about clubs. Unfortunately, I grew up not knowing a lot about them. Whereas Arnold Palmer knew a lot about golf clubs. He loved that. He'd have 1,000 sets of clubs in his home. I had 1 set. 2 sets I'd give them away to some poor kid or somebody. So I played with fiberglass. When I won the Grand Slam, was fiberglass shafts, a fiberglass center ball, and on the longest golf course in the history of the US Open. But there again, ordained. I just putt. You couldn't win it with that equipment.
You had a 16-year-old caddy as well that week. Yeah. So a very inexperienced caddy who says, years on, that he couldn't have done any wrong because you were so in the zone or hypnotized.
Yeah, that's right. Hypnotized was the word. But I putted like just as well as a human being could putt. That's why I won it. But doesn't matter how you win it, because most tournaments are won by good putting anyway, not long driving. Long driving is the most overrated thing in golf, and yet all commentators, that's all they talk about. You only hit 11 drives around, average-wise, but you have an average of 29, 30 putts. It's almost 3-1. Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson were the two worst drivers of a golf ball I've ever seen in world-class play. I'm talking about superstars. To me, to be a superstar, you've got to win 6 majors. That's my version. And those two, but they were number one and number two in the world. Why? Their short game was the best. When I was a young pro, I'd practice hard, but if I had it over again, if I did 8 hours practice, I'd do five hours short game, 3 hours long game. Because the short game is what wins golf tournaments. Look how Jordan Spieth won the Open.
At Birkdale, yeah.
I mean, it was a miracle. I mean, he was all over the place. And he won the tournament.
Some would say your victory of 65 was a bit of a miracle. So you've got fiberglass clubs, you've got a 16-year-old caddy, and just tell us about, you were talking there, you said you were in a hypnotic state.
I was.
So just explain that process.
I didn't recognize my wife. I didn't recognize hardly my family. Of course, I didn't went looking for them, but I wouldn't have answered them had they spoken to me. I mean, it's very similar to Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods was the same. He was in another zone. And that's, if you want to win majors, you've got to be, you can't be walking around playing the fool all the time. Lee Trevino was the closest. He was a lot of talking, but once he got within 50 yards of the ball, he was in another zone. And that's what, and I found that Jack Nicklaus was in another zone. In Ben Hogan, incredible concentration. Sam Snead, who was the strongest athlete that ever played golf and was so talented and never quite won the Grand Slam, but should have, but he didn't have the concentration and in the zone like Hogan, for example.
But there's stories, you can tell me it's true or not. You would look at this Roll of Honor. There was some board, and you'd look at Roll of Honor of the champions.
The US Open.
Yes, for this ahead of this US Open. And you were envisaging your name?
Yes, I did. I went on a Tai Chi position. Tai Chi is when you sit in your haunches like this, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, I do, yeah.
And I looked at the board, and every morning I went to the scoreboard, every morning, and I said, Gary Player there, Gary Player, Gary Player.
And how long would you stand there looking at
it? I looked for 4 minutes. Plus minus, 4 minutes. That's not easy to do that. And I really believe this emphatically, because I was in the position to have to win the Grand Slam to beat Nicklaus and Palmer and Trevino and Casper and all those top players. I really believe if I could have spent 30 minutes with Rory McIlroy the night before the Masters, I believe he could have won it. I really and truly believe that strongly in my heart, because I prepared like no other golfer in the history of the game prepared to win a major championship. And that would take a long time to elaborate on what I did. Never went out to dinner. Went to a Catholic church. I'm not a Catholic. Didn't pray to win. Prayed for patience, courage, certain things to give me the strength, to help me have the strength, not give it to me. Help me. And not to win, because you might have 50 other guys praying to win. Why should he choose me? So I would put myself in the zone. I did things to put myself in the zone.
And it worked.
And it worked, and it worked. And I could have told Rory how to get that into that zone, which, while I watched him play, he was not really what I call in the zone.
That Tai Chi, that comes from, again, back in your youth. That's something that you used in your career, obviously, as it developed, but it was something else that was part of your youth. Didn't you have, I've read this again, read a lot of things, someone would hit you in the face as well? And
That's what I did. That's one of the things I did. I've looked in front of the mirror and I said, patience.
Hitting yourself?
Yeah, hard. Never giving up, you know. Good manners. Not thinking negatively. So you had an association with those thoughts. Whereas most people say, well, we mustn't be rude tomorrow, and the first thing, they're rude to somebody, or they, you know, they might give up, or they might feel sorry for themselves, or something like that. So you had to have a training method, and this is where we're going in the world now. You'll find people in the future. I mentioned this to one man on BBC about 20 years ago that the players would be hitting the ball 400 yards, and he scuffed at me on television.
Ricky Fowler, 471.
Yes, and then also Jordan, Justin Johnson hit a ball 469 in Austin, Texas. Mm-hmm. All the players will hit the ball 400 yards in time to come, and we will cut the ball back. We'll have to. Otherwise, you go to St. Andrews and they'll drive almost 9 greens on the golf course. And that's coming. Because big young fellas today realize that golf has longevity where other sports don't. Tennis, basically you finish when you're 32, average-wise. Every other sport. Golf, I won a tournament at 63 on American Tour. So golf has longevity, so you're going to get big men coming in, massive guys. They're all going to hit the ball 400 yards, and they're going to have great touches, and they're going to have special mind. They're going to have a special mind that they're going to have people that are going to be able to teach it, whereas people today are in their infancy at teaching the mind.
You were there back in the 1960s doing that.
By a blessing, by a divine gift. Why did it happen? Shouldn't have happened.
This guy from South Africa, because you're in amongst the big three. So there's you, Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer. They're American. Everyone that's really come before, generally, in terms of the greats of the game. Again, Bobby Jones, Walter Hagen, Sarrazin. There's no one coming from South Africa.
No, there were no foreigners. There were no foreigners to go over there. Although Bobby Locke went over there and won a lot of golf tournaments, but no majors. And once the international players, the foreigners, saw me when they said, well, I know I can do it now, and I like to feel that I gave them a lot of encouragement, and a lot of them have won. You know, Bernard Lange, you take Immelman, you take Ballesteros. You can go down the list. Vijay Singh.
I'm glad you brought up Seve, because he kind of takes me to your last major victory. 42 years old?
Yes, 42.
1978. Eight. Masters. You talked earlier about how you were capable of making some great comebacks because of the strength of your mind. At the age of 42, would you say that was your greatest comeback?
Yes, I would say so. Although the Open, I think I did, mind you, that was over 36 holes. What a lot of people don't know. Just to digress.
Sure, you can digress.
In the British Open, it was always 36 holes the last day. And if you're tired, you played 36 holes the next day playoff. I ask any young player in this field, he doesn't know that. Not one young player in this field knows that. I told a young guy today, he had no idea. So to come back, what was the question again?
That comeback in the Masters of 78.
So now I'm 7 behind Tom Watson and Hubert Green, and I shoot 30 on the back nine.
Birdied 7 of your last 10 holes.
Birdied 7 out of the last 10 holes and went on to win. So you can see the power of the mind is unbelievable. And I keep putting that there. If I was a young man today, I'd be searching, not only for the swing, I'd be searching for the mind. Even at 83, I'm searching for the mind.
Talent, preparation, skill, mind, where would you rank?
They're all important to be a world champion, all important. But take a guy like Ballesteros, who was my dear, dear friend, and I loved him. Very short career. By the end of his career, he was like an 8 handicap. I played with him at Troon. He couldn't hit a fairway. He couldn't play at all. And you can name the number of players. Nick Faldo had a very short career. You can go down the line. Arnold Palmer, basically. Nicklaus won majors for 25 years. I won for 20, and Palmer won for 6. But the average American thinks Palmer went for 25 because he was so charismatic and such a hero. And I don't blame him because he was a hero.
Listen, I mentioned Seve when I related to that Masters because he played in that final round
with
you.
Yes, he did. And he came up on the 18th green and he gave me a big hug. He says, Gary, I'm so happy you win Masters. Today you teach me how to win Masters. And he won it the next year, I think.
Yeah.
I loved him and I miss him. I miss him. He did an awful lot. He was the Arnold Palmer of Europe.
And when you talk about Palmer and you talk about Jack and you've spoken so highly of him already, you guys, big three, did you always get on? I mean, there you are up against one another trying to
beat the living hang out of each other.
Exactly. So it wouldn't be surprising if there were moments where you weren't exactly on best of terms.
Oh no, we actually had great respect for each other, and Jack Nicklaus was the greatest gentleman I ever played golf with. I played him in the World Match Play Championship twice in the final. And on both times he mentioned on the practice tee some little thing I was doing, and I'm playing him in the final. And I beat him 6-4, 5-4. How many players would do that? Arnold Palmer was the most charismatic golfer that has ever lived. So it's interesting to sum him up, but we were the best of friends. Arnold and I, we cried together, we laughed together, we traveled together, same Jack with us. The latter part, Jack came in after us. And we traveled around the world not getting millions of dollars for prize money. I think appearance money is going to hurt golf. And Peter Thompson, who Bobby Jones was the most well-spoken, best-dressed, highly educated golfer that ever played, gentleman. Peter Thompson was close on his heels as far as education, dress code, manners. And Bobby Jones, I don't know, my mind is working very quickly. Bobby Jones might have been the best player that ever lived. He might have been, because he played with a shaft that was wood, chamois grip, irons with no grooves, a golf ball that went 100 yards less. And in 1927, he shot 285 at St. Andrews, and they never changed the cup one day. They never raked the bunkers, and they never had machines to cut the greens properly or the fairways. So, and there were spike marks all over the green. Genius.
You've obviously seen some magical golf over the years. You've played it, you've experienced it. Do you sometimes, are you able to have that kind of an out-of-body experience and realize everything you've achieved? Or when you're achieving it yourself, does that lessen it somewhat?
Good question. When you're playing and you're achieving it, I'm expecting to do it every week. Now I sit back and say, how the hang did I do it? How did I win all this tournament? I traveled from France to Royal Melbourne to play in the Australian Open. Jack Arnold and I were going. They bailed out because the travel agent came and said, look, we washed out today. You're going to leave on Tuesday instead of Monday. I can get you to Royal Melbourne 3 hours before you play if you want to gamble. They withdrew. I went New York. You didn't have those passages, shortcuts in those days. New York, Los Angeles, Hawaii, Fiji, Sydney, Melbourne. Got there 3.5 hours, never seen Royal Melbourne. New clubs, different ball. Won the Australian Open by 7 shots and a 16-hour time change. That is not possible for me to do. That is ordained.
Did you enjoy it?
Of course I did enjoy it. I loved it because I worked so hard. I was such an animal with practice. Even today, I mean, at 83.
But did you enjoy the winning?
Oh, yes. When you work hard in life, when you work hard and you achieve something, you definitely enjoy it more than a man who's got lots of money, had a great lifestyle. There's no question that people that struggle in life appreciate it and have more gratitude in their hearts. That is a fact.
We've talked about all these wonderful victories you've had, your first major, the Grand Slam, your final major. I've heard you say that even though it's down as 9 majors, you feel like you've won 10 majors.
Well done, you've done your homework. I'm impressed, thank you.
There'll be people listening to this that won't understand why you have that sentiment.
Well, being from South Africa and having practiced the apartheid system, they wanted to kill me every day. Every day they wanted to kill me around the world for 2 years. So I had to play under those conditions. I had policemen sleeping in my house every night with guns. I had 20 policemen at least walking around the golf course, protecting me. If I went to the toilet, there were 6 policemen there with me. And every night I went to bed, there were 3 policemen in my house with guns. And so it was very difficult to play. And the PGA at Dayton, Ohio, I lost by 1 shot to Raymond Floyd. They threw telephone books in my back while I was swinging. They threw ice in my eyes from green to tee. They charged me on the green. They threw balls between my legs when I was getting to make a crucial putt. They screamed on my backswing, charged me out of the galleries, and tore up the greens, and I lost by 1 shot.
This was in 1969?
1969 at Dayton, Ohio, PGA.
Obviously, as you mentioned there, you feared for your life for 2 years, so I don't expect you to have not had some negative feelings about it, but was there part of you that understood?
I understood it 100%, because South Africa was practicing the wrong system, and that we all knew, that was not the right system to practice, and I knew that the way, I was then at that stage a world champion, and the best way they could get their message across was to go for me.
Because you were the most high-profile sportsman.
Best known South African.
Sure.
So that was their way to do it. And I, you know what I did? I eventually went and met them, these people that are demonstrating.
At this?
Later. I went and met them, and I said, look, you know, if you just take the problem to see what I've done in South Africa for our underprivileged people, you'd be surprised and you wouldn't demonstrate against me anymore. And they did. They sent a man called Mr. Williams across. I said, I don't want to go with him. Let him go. And he came back. He says, Gary Player's looking after caddies. He's sponsoring golfers. He's sponsoring tournaments for black players. And I never had another day's problem.
I haven't mentioned your wife, and I know she's been a huge part, obviously, of your life. She's been there nearly every step of that way. What was she saying to you at this time? Because as you mentioned, you've got all these guards and, you know, people threatening your life. I know what most wives would be like. Yeah. They wouldn't be happy about the situation.
No, she was very concerned, but my wife has been a stalwart. What my wife has done for me is unbelievable. Anybody else being married to me would have run away and been divorced, but she did play golf, she understood it, and we've been married for 61 years.
Her brother was a golfer,
wasn't he? Yeah, and won the British Open Seniors and won a tournament on the American Tour.
So she understood what golf
was
like.
And her father was a golf pro, right. And her mother was a 7 handicap. So my wife we've been married 61 years, we have 22 grandchildren, 6 children and 1 great-grandchild. So my wife has been a stalwart.
But what was she saying to you at this point?
She said, you must make the decision. Whatever you do, I'll be with you. To go home and quit, or keep playing.
So your attitude at the time, obviously, was to keep playing. You nearly won the major, you nearly won that championship, for goodness sake. Yeah. With all these things being thrown at you, again, was that
well, golf, I was
the
obsessed.
Mental state?
I was obsessed about being a champion. And as I said, I went to these guys, I said, if you want to kill me, you don't have to kill me on the golf course, you can kill me now. Kill me now. I said, well, I'm not going to go home and run away. See, these are things that very few people understand, the difficulties that I've had to play. Had I been born an American, I tell you, I would have won at least, I believe, 14 majors. I really believe that. And yet America was practicing apartheid at the same time we were, but they were the might of the world, and we were a little country. So we, you know, they could do it against me. They never did it against Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus, did they? And yet they were practicing their own apartheid at that time.
Yeah, and it was a global thing, obviously, the anti-apartheid feeling. Yeah. If I can use the expression, which is probably not the best, it was very black and white the way it was in South Africa.
Yeah, but so was
Africa.
In America. There was no difference. In America, it was the same thing. They weren't allowed to drink in the fountains. They weren't allowed to go into bars. Charlie Sifford, who was inducted into the Hall of Fame, a black gentleman, he asked me as a white South African to induct him into the Hall of Fame because I stuck up for him. When he wasn't allowed to play in America, he wasn't allowed to play and was a very, very good player. And I was vociferous about this. And eventually they did let him play. And he never forgot my support. And he asked me, of all the people he could ask to induct him to the Hall of Fame, he asked me, a whitey from South Africa. What an honor.
He was racially assaulted, wasn't he?
I don't know about assaulted, but I played with him at Greensboro. Mm. And they were saying, what are you doing here, nigger? And they kick his ball in the rough, and I saw them, and I called the PGA over. I said, "This guy, his ball was on the fairway. We were able to take it back out of the rough and drop it back on the fairway. Then he took his pencil like this, and he went to the table like this. He said, how can you play with all this S-H-I-T going on? And I said, Charlie, I understand. I have the same problem, my brother. And I said, hang in there. You're a tough man, hang in there. And he did, and he eventually had a great life. And he did very well, and I was able to have a great friend.
There was a time where, in the mid-60s, where you certainly wrote down that you supported the system.
Well, not quite, but we had a man do a book on me, and I really wasn't interested in a book. And I said, you write the book, unfortunately. And he came out with some things which I didn't really believe, which I was not practicing at the time. And it was my fault. I should have, you know, read the book. But in those days, you're playing golf, you don't worry about reading books and all these other things. You're obsessed with playing golf. And also, you must understand, it was like Germany. We were brainwashed.
You're talking about in South Africa.
Yeah, we
now.
Were brainwashed as people. If you stood up, you know, you had to be very careful. You could be put in jail for 90 days. You could be put away. We were brainwashed in our country. We were all petrified. People were scared to say things. You can't blame them.
Did people in power, given your profile, want to use you?
Explain that.
Well, there'd be certain political leaders that would love to be associated with someone who's bringing such glory to the name of South Africa.
Nelson Mandela, President Nelson Mandela, was fantastic. He requested when he came out of prison to meet me. which was such an honor because I just loved Nelson Mandela. He was our father. And every time I was around him, I wanted to cry. And he said, I'm inviting you because, first of all, in 1961, in the midst of apartheid, you said, release Mandela. And also, you're my number one ambassador. And so I said, sir, if I can be a quarter of the ambassador you are, I'll be very happy. So that was a great thing in my life. And then we raised a lot of money, President Mandela and myself, for young black kids. We changed the lives of many thousands, which was a big, big thrill in my life.
So you've achieved so much, and I want to talk about what you're doing now as well. You've achieved so much, you've come, I'm not going to compare you to Nelson Mandela at all, but you've gone through your hardships, you've achieved a lot for whatever reasons, you believe it's a divine thing, but whatever, you've done it, you've achieved it.
I'll enlarge on what you said about world record. If you say, who's the best golfer that ever lived? I say Jack Nicklaus, without a hesitation. But I have the best world record in golf of anybody. Australian Open 7, 13 South African Opens, Brazilian, win in Japan, win in Britain, this 3 senior opens and 3 normal opens. 9 majors on the senior tour, which were better than 9 majors on the regular tour. The only player in the world to win the Grand Slam on the regular tour and senior tour in the world. Think about it, in the world. How blessed are you in the total world? So my world record is better than Nicklaus's. My world record. But I don't say I'm a better golfer than Jack Nicklaus, although I was never scared of him. But Jack Nicklaus's record in majors and in America is the best in the world. And that's a fact.
You're 82 now, and yet here you are having a lifetime of traveling and...
working hard.
Yeah, this work ethos. And that came from your dad, didn't it?
Yes.
Just to go touch back on that.
Yes. Yes, it did, because retirement is a death warrant. When I hear people say they want to retire, you're going to die unless you really keep working. Before I stop, before I die, they'll have to throw the dirt over me. I'm not going to stop. I'm 82 and I work almost as hard as I did when I was 25. I travel around the world. I mean, if you saw what I've got, if you can look at my itinerary. Johann Rupert, who's one of the top businessmen in the world, looked at my itinerary one day and said, there's no human being that has an itinerary like this. I could go to my room now and you can mention the 10th of September, the 11th of October, the 2nd of December, and I'll tell you exactly what time I'm doing things.
So, is it purely a way of just...
staying young.
Staying young and staying alive.
And staying alive, staying active. You've got to keep moving. The day you stop moving, the day you start to put on weight, the day you start to put on weight, you're starting to die. You've got to understand that. And this is what's not told in schools. I think the schooling system around the world is pathetic. We don't teach people enough about manners. They're taking exercise out of almost all the schools. The kids are becoming obesity. More people are dying of obesity than all the world's wars put together. Diabetes is becoming an epidemic here, everywhere in the world. America will have 100 million people die of diabetes in 40 to 50 years unless they find a better cure than insulin. And the best cure is learn to eat properly and exercise. But no, people are not interested in exercise and eating properly. It is easier to get a camel through the eye of a needle than to get somebody to worry about health.
And that's where my train of thought was going. I wanted to ask you about your legacy.
There's no such thing as a legacy.
Go on, explain that.
Winston Churchill, my all-time hero. Greatest leader the world probably ever had. If you went to the schools around the world today, they'd have no idea who Winston Churchill is. No idea. That's the sad thing, that if it wasn't for Winston Churchill, we would not be playing the British Open this year. Think about it. You and I wouldn't be sitting here in this room if it wasn't for Winston Churchill. And yet, there's no legacy. Educated people, schools in Britain, know about him. But you went to America or South Africa.
But you said there's no such thing as legacy.
No, that's gone.
Well, hold on. In 100 years' time, people will look back at... That's why I'm saying how you... Your legacy, would you like it to be someone who broke down some of these barriers of apartheid in South Africa, sporting-wise?
Yes.
Someone who talked about health and fitness? Or someone who achieved as much as they did in their golf career?
I mean, yes, I would like to be known as a man who helped break down apartheid. I could give you a list of 40 things I did to break apartheid, okay? Significant things. I could give you a list of, I speak to 1.4 billion people a year, they hear my voice in the world. China, India, USA, Europe, South Africa, on fitness. But if I can get 50,000 to listen, it's an amazing achievement. But nobody will remember me. And I don't want them to. I don't want to be buried in a graveyard with my name on a rock. I want my name to be on the hearts of people. I don't want to be buried for a start. I want to be cremated. And the thing is this, because we're using up the ground and life is for the living. That's only my political, religious point of view. And I'm lucky. I can give you my political and I can give you my philosophy and what I believe in death and living. But 70% of the world today, there's no political freedom. There's no religious freedom. Think about it, 70% of the world. And the other 30% of the world, it's on the wane. If you go to Berkeley University in California, for example, I'm a conservative and I want to talk. They wouldn't allow me to talk. They turn my car over and maybe break a few windows in the building. So where's the freedom? There's no more freedom. If you say something that's not politically correct as an athlete or a businessman, you're finished. You can't say what you believe.
Do you feel when you're now talking, I mean, say we're sitting here now, that you might say
still
the wrong thing?
I'm very scared now, because as a young man, there was political there was freedom, and you could say something and people wouldn't like it. But today they destroy you. You're destroyed. And so you've got to be very, with the media system as it is today, with cell phones, well, you know, the media that exists, you've got to be very careful.
I want to take a photo of us when we finish this, but you're dressed all in black.
Mm-hmm.
That's obviously something that you've done the whole of your career. Where did that start?
Well, it started being from South Africa, a black country, and it was a form of striving to help blacks survive in South Africa. And I wore a pair of black legs and a white leg in the British Open at St Andrews. And that was a quiet demonstration, just a couple of the things against apartheid. And it was so gratifying that when I met Nelson Mandela, and as again I'm being repetitive, requested to meet me. What an honor. And when I was in his room with him, I said, "You must have hatred for the white man and revenge." He said, "To the contrary. It was a handful of people that persecuted me, not all white people. I love white people. I have no revenge. And Gary, you've got to learn to forgive in life." And my goodness me, I'm going to use the word hell's teeth. When you visit his cell in Robben Island, 10 foot by 7, 20 years in that jail, and all the political prisoners that were there, they came out and were humble, full of love and forgiving. And I went to see his cell. And I did 50 push-ups in a movie I was doing for Rolex in aid of those people, to tell them how much I loved them and appreciated their love, because the greatest word that exists in our lives, or the English dictionary, or the Quran, or the book of Judaism, or the book of Hinduism, whatever it may be, is love. That's the greatest word that exists. That is true God. But today we're divided in the world. We're ready for another war. We are ready for an atomic war. That's the tragedy. I mean, you hear, it's frightening what you hear in the world today. That was not Mandela. Mandela was not like that. He preached the opposite. So did Mahatma Gandhi. So did Mother Teresa. So did Billy Graham, the great leaders of the world. Preached peace. Martin Luther King preached peace. You can't preach war. You can't preach hatred. Because if you live by the sword, you'll die by the sword.
It's clear you have your philosophy, and that's coming across here. But if I can just go back to where we are now in terms of golf as well. When you look at the game where it is now and where it's going, do you think golf's in a healthy state?
Professional golf has never been so healthy, ever. It's the most healthy it's ever been. In fact, it's beyond one's dreams, and it's nice to know we all played a role in making it that way. But golf as a sport is in trouble. We don't have enough people to fill the vacuums of the memberships. Golf is too slow. When I see golf pros with a book, they've had two rounds in a tournament on a green looking, taking out a book to look at where to putt. That worries me. I can go to a golf course I've never been in my life and never misread a putt. And yet they've got a book and they're taking too much time. And golf is becoming a slow game, and that is what people don't want. And the golf courses, because the ball's going so far, they're making their golf courses longer. We're running out of water. Fertilizer's poison for the ground. It's more machinery. The costs go up, more labor. The game then becomes where you have to levy members and they don't want it, so they stop playing. We are going the wrong way with the game of golf. We've got to change. We've got to change rapidly. We can't stop a young kid taking a cell phone to a golf course anymore. I don't like that. I don't like it, but we can't stop that. Otherwise, they're going to go to cycling and other sports that are not time-consuming. We've got to build golf courses that are shorter. I've just designed it. We've designed over 300 golf courses in the world. We just designed a golf course in America, 13 holes. You can go with your family and play 6 holes, 9 holes, 12 holes, 30 holes, and get out of there and spend the day with your family. We've got to do a lot of thinking. We've got to leave the equipment as it is for amateurs. Let them use what they like. Not stop the long putter for the amateurs. Professional golfers, you've got to stop it. You've got to stop the ball back 50 yards, otherwise it's going to be a joke. It's just going to be not the game of golf. And so we've got to do a lot of thinking. And these people that say that the golf is the same for amateurs as it is for professionals are in dream world. If you think you're in the same league, go and watch Dustin Johnson hit a driver, and you'll realize that it's out of this world.
Sure.
So we've got to... We need the right leaders in golf, and we've got a lot of new young guys coming up. And Churchill said, change is the price of survival. You need leaders with vision, and we are changing all the time. And sometimes what we thought was not good as a young man, today it is brilliant, and you realize how wrong you were. And I made mistakes in my life, and I said things that I shouldn't say, the same as everybody did, the same as Phil Mickelson. He's been the number one PR for golf of all pros. He does one thing wrong in the US Open, and everybody jumps on him, forgetting that they've also made mistakes. Winston Churchill said, I'm never embarrassed by putting my foot in my mouth. I just changed my diet.
You were a great supporter of the Sunshine Tour. Do you wish that maybe the South African players of nowadays would be as supportive of the events in South Africa as you were?
Well, it's different times. I believe that every South African player should play at least 4 tournaments a year in South Africa. I did that. And I was playing around the world in all the big championships and trade. But I made a point to build and make sure that tour survives. And I really believe it. Now they come, but they want big appearance money to come. And I think Peter Thompson said, as I said, and I'm going to be repetitive, appearance money can hurt this game so badly in the future. The managers are so greedy. I mean, I hear one player who's never won a major. If they want him to go someplace that he doesn't want to go to, his fee's $600,000. We asked one player to play in the Gary Player Foundation Day at Wentworth. He was a troon. They would send a jet to pick him up, stay in a beautiful hotel. He wanted $500,000 to play for the one day. For the one day. Now, we pay everybody who plays, but within reason. I got appearance money, but within reason. Something that the sponsors could afford. Now they're pricing themselves out of the game. Why? Because there's so much money.
But how do you stop it then?
You don't. That's the next problem we're going to face in professional golf. That's still coming. That's coming. Because you take the tournament we have in South Africa, it was the biggest prize money in the world, magnificent golf course. They look after you better than any tournament in the world. And now you want them to come and play? They want $500,000, an ordinary player, not a champion, $250,000, an ordinary player. And the sponsors can't afford it. So where does it go? Now you're in trouble. Same in Britain. How many players do you think come along and played in that magnificent PGA at Wentworth, the BMW PGA, a magnificent tournament on a magnificent course? They're not coming. And yet they want to think of themselves as world beaters. No, they're not world beaters until they can go outside of their own backyard and win.
Which brings us back to you, which you've done, as I say, 165 tournaments worldwide. It's been an incredible life story. From, we talked about your humble beginnings and this young boy who wanted to die, you know, didn't want to be around. Just that young boy then, 8 years old, crying yourself to sleep. Can you believe that now at the age of 82, looking back at that young boy, that you could be where you are now?
I'll tell you this as a fact. There's not a day of my life, did you hear that? A day that I don't go on my hands and knees. A man is never so tall as when he's on his knees. There's never a day that goes by that I don't say a prayer 5 times a day of thanks and gratitude. Because these eyes have seen things that nobody else in the world has seen. And I realize how fortunate I am. And the other thing is, as a South African, which I'm proud of, I've played in front of more people live than any South African has ever appeared live in front of people. And I've been on television more than any South African ever in front of people for 63 years. Politicians in the world are there. Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus played in front of more people than Obama or any president ever, or live. And the same as players today. Because we there, I've been there for 63 years and still continue to do it. In the Masters this year, how many people do you think saw me teal for the Masters and play the par three? 1.4 billion. Think about it. So a golfer is in a position to do more so than any other sportsman, because other sportsmen don't last. A soccer player, Pele, mention who you like, Ronaldo, they finished when they're 32, 33. Think of tennis. Federer is an exception. Most players are finished when they're 33, 34. Golf, you haven't reached your prime. I won the Masters at 42. Nicklaus won it at 46. And somebody will win it at 50 one day. So we are so blessed. And we must never forget that. It's a simple word called thank you.
Well, let me say thank you for chatting with me today. It's been, as I said before, an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
It really was a pleasure talking to Gary Player. I mean, talking to one of the all-time greats, how could it not be? It was hard work because Gary Player or Mr. Player kept veering off into, you know, his various crusades that he has, and I wanted it to be about him and to be able to tell his story. So hopefully that came across. And the other thing I'm sure you're aware is, my goodness me, I mean, what a diary he has. Please God, I'm anywhere near like that in my 80s. In fact, I'm nowhere near in my 40s than he is in his 80s. It's quite incredible, really. At this point, though, I want to thank the new sponsors who have got on board. So big thanks to both Navigate Constructing and to Red Ray as well. Your help really means a lot. And please do get in touch. It'd be nice to get a bit of interaction going, and maybe I can go through one or two of your thoughts about this week's podcast ahead of one or two of the other podcasts. So if you do want to get in touch with me, and I say it's really welcome. On Twitter, it's at The Round Podcast. And on Facebook, it's at The Round Golf Podcast. And something I didn't really push enough during season one is those ratings. Really important. 5-star would be nice, but whatever. Anything will do. It just helps it become more visible, this podcast, to people who haven't listened before, so people know it's out there, basically. Listen, thanks so much for listening to the Round Golf Podcast, and I can't wait to bring you the next episode.